It's Consumer Protection Day on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And our guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, are from Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, otherwise known as DATCAP. Michelle's the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael is the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. They're here to share the latest stories of scams and frauds and attempted scams and frauds we've seen around the state, but they're also here to hear from you. Answer your questions and hear your stories about attempted frauds and scams that you've seen or come across. Strange phone calls, awkward emails. How are you staying safe on the internet and elsewhere? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. Michelle and Michael, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thank you for having us. We're excited to be here, as always.
Thanks, Lee.
Yeah. So I would be interested in knowing what the common theme would be from the complaints that you've received over this past month across Wisconsin. What did you hear from Wisconsin consumers? Is there a central theme to the most current scam attempts?
There really is. It's consumers taking a minute to make sure they know who they're talking to, because we are seeing so many variations of the imposter scam. That's a really broad category to say imposter scam, but these individuals are impersonating government agencies at the state level, the federal level, local level. They're impersonating your boss. They are impersonating large, well-known companies that consumers interact with on a daily basis. And we're seeing it from every avenue, using every different form of technology, whether it's your cell phone, your mailbox, your computer, social media, and we need to make sure that consumers have that very broad awareness that often who you're interacting with may not be who you think it is, and you can't just trust it on the surface. You need to take some steps, do some verification, take a minute to think about what's in front of you to determine if it's legitimate. And that may involve talking with friends and family and chatting it through. In the complicating factor that we're really seeing growing is that artificial intelligence is creeping into this scam world, and it's making it even more difficult to understand who you're talking to, because some of the old tips we used to provide aren't going to work for you anymore to determine that who you're talking to is a scammer.
So, Michael, what's the best way to suss out an imposter? What steps do you take to figure out who you're talking to?
Well, it depends on what the context of that conversation is and who they're purporting to be. The first is, as Michelle mentioned, taking a second to just pause and not react to that immediacy they're going to create for you. Oftentimes, the common theme you're going to see is a sense of urgency. You have to act immediately, or there's going to be some type of penalty or bad action. So that in itself is going to be one of those red flags to help you help determine that that might be a scam. The other is you want to take a second and then research who you are talking about if you have an opportunity. So for instance, if that imposter is purporting to be the city of Madison, you want to take a step back and then go and find out what the real city of Madison's contact information is and reach out to them and ask them, is this legitimate, this call that I got, whatever they're threatening to happen. Same with the other types that we see, whether it be utility company calling or a federal agency, if you're participating in a program, it's just not reacting to what they're telling you or the information that they're providing to you, and then turning around that flow of communication, and you're the one that's going to reach out and verify.
Step one, stop, pause, just take a moment for yourself, regardless of what the other person is telling you about the urgency or immediacy of your action that is needed. That is probably the first red flag to stop right there. Second is don't react to them, but take an action yourself. Figure out a way to communicate with whoever they say claim to be on your terms. So don't take their phone call, make your phone call. Don't take their email. You reach out and connect. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
The other thing that keeps, because I've seen this in my own email inbox recently, is, hey, this is the corporate office. You mind going to get me a gift card? Who in the professional world communicates through gift cards?
The scammers.
Yeah, right?
That's the answer.
Nobody else is, my boss is not asking me to go get a Target gift card for them, no matter what.
I would say 99.9% of the time that is correct. I don't want to say ever because you may find one or two bosses that need it for there. But by and large, if you're having your boss reach out, and especially if it's getting those gift cards, but then the other red flag giveaway is when the boss says, send me the numbers on the back. Send me those verification codes.
Yes.
Go ahead and scratch them off. That's going to all be a, hey, wait, this is definitely not going to be correct.
Chances are transactions are not taking place in gift cards if they're legit and above board.
Gift cards are meant for giving.
So among the government imposters that the debt cap has seen over the last month, Wisconsin Department of Transportation, the city of Green Bay, and debt cap itself, how are they posing as you?
Yeah, so we learned from some of our licensees that they had gotten email messages indicating that they needed to renew their license, and that was by providing their private information to our, quote, agency. Well, that is not the way our license renewal process works at all. We do, you know, notify those that engage in a license with us that it's time for renewal. Go here, log in, you know, to do that. They've been through the process once before for their original license and any renewal since then. And you would then just need to make your payment, but we don't ask for private information, that personally identifiable information as part of it. So we sent out the alert to our licensees to make sure that they were on the lookout for this. But we put it out there for people to know that were even being, you know, impersonated with individuals. We think they may have gotten some of our license lists from publicly available data files that are, you know, on the website. But you need to be cautious of that and know who you're interacting with. You know, we end in a Wisconsin.gov. So if someone else is a .us, Wisconsin or wisconsin.us.com or .org or something else, that's going to be different. We've certainly seen other municipalities that have been impacted in different ways when they interact with their citizen group that they oversee as well. And so the catch there for individuals was really paying attention to the email extension. They'd set up a lookalike email, but it was just a little different. It was the city's name, the at whatever.gov, whereas they set it up with city of whatever dot. So you really need to be mindful and watch that and verify. That's that third component of what you were saying earlier. We have to stop and pause and look at things. We need to decide how we're going to act or react to something. But before taking that step, we need to verify as well. And that it was an important step for the municipality situation.
Yeah. Where are these scammers coming from? Do we know? Can we find a source? Are they here in Wisconsin? Are they elsewhere? And what recourse do we have against them?
I would say the answer to that is everywhere.
Everywhere.
They're everywhere. And so identifying the origin of the source sometimes can be difficult through the masking efforts that they make and, you know, the time and effort they put into not being traceable or being able to be found. You know, one element of that is something we talk about called spoofing, where they will fabricate a different number that displays on your caller ID or even an email address, as we're talking about, that doesn't look the same. And so then trying to backtrace through that as what was the origin number. And most of us don't have the tools or resources to do that. So, you know, as a common consumer, you're not going to know really where that is coming from. But also then we see these technologies being used that would route them through different areas. And so, you know, you can oftentimes identify maybe where the source of the call came from, but you can't really identify who was making that call all the time. So the answer to the question is everywhere, both domestic and international.
Do we have an idea if these are lone wolves, if it's organized crime, if it's state actions from elsewhere?
Well, I think, again, the answer to that is probably D, all of the above. You know, I couldn't pinpoint whether there's a higher percentage of each or. We are seeing, certainly it's not uncommon to see organized groups almost being run like businesses where they're having scam operations. And the whole purpose is to send out these communications and then, you know, have that net income that comes back. And, you know, even as elaborate as some of them having pay structures and how you're having maybe an HR department. And so it's not just, you know, that the proverbial somebody sitting in your garage, you know, sending out messages and hoping to get rich. A lot of this can be organized and you're seeing these efforts being put out. But again, there may be just one-offs here and there.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, we've certainly worked with the Wisconsin Department of Justice and our other federal partners. We talked before we went on air about pig butchering, and I'm sure we'll get to that in detail. But that's an example of a scam where it's a ring. Individuals are being extorted, really, to perform and reach to earn their food for the day. I mean, it's when you see some of the photos of some of those rings that have been broken up, it's horrendous conditions and things that they have. But there are some people overseen, and they're just trying to survive and have to perform on these scams. So there's a whole variation of what's happening.
I didn't want to have any sympathy for these scammers, but all of a sudden...
Well, you don't have sympathy for the person that's overseen.
Yeah.
It's the one that's, you know, having to make the call.
Got an email here from Peter in Eden. He received three calls yesterday, all from different numbers, all saying the same thing, because he's been getting these calls daily from a business that says, quote, "This message is from the tax resolution team. You've been marked for IRS resolution options." And goes on to explain that Peter can opt out by pressing the number 9, but there are three points Peter wants to make here. One, he's on the do not call list. Two, he's never contacted this outfit. And three, he has call blocking and only gets the message in voicemail. The calls come from many states and different numbers, so blocking one number doesn't seem to work. What can Peter do? Press 9?
No. Michael and I were racing. Who could say that faster? No, please.
Do not press 9.
I'm gonna say do not press 9, do not press 1, do not press anything.
Do not engage.
Do not engage on this. I'm gonna say step 2, file a complaint. Because he's on the do not call list. This sounds a mix of a government imposter as well as a company trying to do a resolution based on the name. And that is something where we enforce. And when they bypass ringing your phone and go straight to voicemail, that is still a call. And so that is something we still want to know about if they're bypassing and just dropping a voicemail into your box. So that might be something new for people to have heard from us, but it's definitely our position. And we want to hear those kinds of complaints on that.
Absolutely. And I also want to just touch on, with Peter being on the do not call list, is making sure that you're letting us know when those calls do come through, especially on your list, because it offers us another opportunity to look at whether that business is complying. But also, I want to dispel kind of a perception that the do not call list doesn't work, and that's not true. The do not call list does work. What it does, though, is it'll reduce those calls from, you know, businesses that are looking to comply with the law, and sometimes they, you know, step outside of it sometimes. But also, some of these scammers, they don't care about the law. They don't care about this list.
Right.
And so, you know, we sometimes hear that, well, the do not call list doesn't work, so I'm still getting all of these. Well, that's because the scammers are just disregarding the law. It's no different than if you have somebody who's, you know, you post a speed limit sign and they're speeding and they're saying, well, they're still speeding. Well, that's because they're disregarding what's happening.
Right.
So I still want to encourage everyone to sign up for the do not call registry. It does work. It does provide that service that we're advertising and promoting in the use of it. Just don't expect that obviously every single call is suddenly going to stop.
But when you do get those calls that are clearly scammers or spammers, that reporting them to DatCap would be the step in the right direction and the best chance at seeing these to some degree cut off or reduced, at least.
It absolutely is. And some of our larger cases have started with just one phone call. You know, us looking at that phone call, being able to find out who made that, and then kind of peeling the onion back and where did it come from? What were they advertising? And then holding that business accountable. Now, it doesn't mean that we can find out all of them.
Right.
But also just reporting them, even if you let us know, it also helps us identify if there's a pattern from the same phone number coming through or, you know, just be you report it and then I report it. Well, now we're starting to see what's happening. So it all starts with reporting, and that's the important part.
And you can do that. We've tried to make it really easy directly online. So you can go to datcp.wi.gov to file that complaint. We have two different kinds of no-call complaint forms. The long version, where you're going to provide a ton of details because you've actually interacted. And then we have a short form, a fast track, where you're just giving the number and kind of a very brief one-line type description that we follow on. And those we don't follow back with you about because we're compiling all the data. It doesn't mean we're not looking at them. We absolutely are, to Michael's point. But the long version, we'll send you a letter back. If you don't need to hear from us and you know we're going to take a look at it, you can just do the fast-track version. You can also just call the hotline and have a form sent out to you, or do the fast-track reporting by giving them the numbers over the phone. And that phone number is 1-800-422-7128.
That is datcp.wi.gov or 1-800-422-7128. I'll give you the contact information again in a moment. Our guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke here. It's Consumer Protection Day on the Larry Mueller Show. Want to invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. Coming up at 12:30 today, more about how the immigration process is being changed. A Madison-based immigration attorney joins us to talk about the process towards U.S. citizenship right now. But right now, we're talking with Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And this is all about consumer protection today at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or stories. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. That's 800-642-1234 to contact us, or email talk@wpr.org. The contact information for consumer protection complaints, again, that's DATCAP's website at datcp.wi.gov. And their hotline is 1-800-422-7128. That's datcp.wi.gov and 1-800-422-7128. Michael, can you give us a little bit of what it looks like when you begin taking a file complaint and how you follow through with it for consumer protection?
I can. So there's several ways you can file a complaint with us. The quickest is to file online through our online portal, and that's at the website you just mentioned. You also can call our hotline, and we'd be happy to mail out a complaint to you. Or you can download that complaint on the same website, print it out, mail it in to us. So a variety of ways to get that information to us. I will also mention you have the ability to come into our office and go ahead and sit down with someone, and we'll work through that complaint with you. And then after that complaint is received, we have go ahead and file it, get it assigned to a mediator, and then that mediator will kind of reach out, we'll get a letter that says, here's what we received your complaint, here's what you can expect. We'll reach out to the business, whoever the complaint is regarding, let them know that a complaint has been filed, ask them for a response based on what we learned, and then we just kind of work back and forth to make sure we can try and reach that resolution. Concurrently, we'll also look and see if there's anything that maybe the business needs to tighten up or do a little bit better, and we'll work with them to help them with their business practices to be compliant and make sure that we're on the right path moving forward. And so then they'll hopefully get that resolution. And that's kind of the basic structure of how the complaint process works.
What are the limits of consumer protection in Wisconsin? How are you, how do you keep your charge? What sort of things can you do when it comes to enforcement and the law?
Well, so there's several, about 60 laws and rules under our authority that we'll work under. And so if we receive a complaint that falls within the scope of those rules, we will work to try and resolve the issue. We'll kind of identify if there's any violation of those laws that we had and work to rectify that. If there's anything that falls outside our scope and we know that there's another agency that has the authority over that, we'll refer that complaint to them because they're going to have a better idea of what to be looking for and a little bit better opportunity to resolve that for the consumer. So it's kind of, if it falls within one of those two, if it falls outside the scope, we'll still try and work with that business and that consumer to try and find a resolution and work on their behalf. But that, by and large, falls within the scope there.
Michelle?
And I would say, you know, as to your question about what our limits are.
Yeah.
This is going to sound, you know, very government, I suppose, but our limitations also are we're here to provide consumer protection on behalf of the state of Wisconsin and the citizens that live in the state or interact in our state, but we can't personally represent an individual. So if someone files a complaint and they want to sue the company or proceed and get a particular resolution, We mediate, we investigate, mm-hmm. we refer to our federal and state partners and district attorney's offices. If we find something that we believe could be a violation, investigate that and move forward those allegations. But that, again, is on behalf of the state. There might be restitution for a consumer involved in that, but we're not doing it to get that one consumer back. We're not representing that consumer. They have to do that privately if they want through other resources. We're also not the courts. And so we don't get to make that final determination and say, yes, they're wrong. We can allege it. We'll move forward with our legal partners if we believe that to be true and see that pattern of conduct within the complaint trends and resources.
But you can't be judge and jury.
But we don't get to do that. No. And we don't have the ability to just fine a company.
Do you have the resources that you need to follow through on the complaints that you get?
We have a wonderful team that we have, and we're supported. Everything has resource constraints,
right.
But we are able to bring forward a number of investigations to our district attorney and Department of Justice legal partners to proceed. They mediate over 10,000, near 11,000 complaints on an annual basis. And the amount of money that's returned to consumers varies year to year from, you know, $2.5 million up to $24 million because of the time a case may take from when it's brought to when it's resolved and what that resolution is. So, a lot of good is done and a lot is accomplished, and those consumer protections are there, but we don't have laws for everything that we see.
Right. You talk about your partnership with other state organizations, state departments, but also federal partnerships. And I saw the Big Beautiful Bill included cuts to the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I'm wondering if that has any ramifications for consumer protection and DATCAP, Michelle.
Well, we work primarily with the Federal Trade Commission more than the CFPB because of our authority being over deceptive trade practices and not the financial practices aspect of it. So we do end up referring complaints that we receive to our state partner, Department of Financial Institutions, or to the CFPB. And, you know, of course, we're monitoring the results of those situations, but our authority doesn't lie in that area.
Right.
We work, again, with the Federal Trade Commission, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Environmental Protection Agencies, in the areas of law that the Bureau of Consumer Protection has.
That's Michelle Reinen along with Michael Domke. They're our consumer protection experts from the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Here to answer your questions, but our phones are on the fritz right now, so you're going to have to submit an email, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org, and we'll pass your questions on to our experts. But in the meantime, you had mentioned artificial intelligence and how this is now being used for attempted scams, and I was thinking, we talked to a guest about a month ago on this show who is an AI expert, and he wasn't so concerned about AI taking over the world. He was more concerned about AI being used for frauds and scams. So how are we seeing artificial intelligence being employed to try to bilk us of our money?
Well, it's being used in a variety of ways, and commonly what we're going to talk about is these scams are, by and large, for the most part, staying the same, like the common themes that we're seeing. The problem is AI is making them more convincing. It's making them a little bit more difficult to determine, is this real or is it not? And one example is the chatbots. And so, you know, we think about AI and it seems to be new, but in reality, AI and these type of technologies have been around for a bit. And a chatbot is a good explanation where you go onto a website and little box pops up and it says, hey, can I help you with something? You know, it's been around for a long time.
Yep.
You know, that's a primitive version of the AI that's responsive to what you're typing in. The advancements, though, of AI has made those texts and conversations more responsive to what you're saying, also quicker. But what also is that technology now allows that interaction between the consumer and that chatbot to be a little bit more convincing. And so if there's a scammer behind it, you're not quite as sure to be able to pick out, because before we could see that, well, that response doesn't make sense. I can tell it's a computer. Now the computer is actually going to be responsive like a real person. So if you're having a chat or a dialogue, maybe on a dating website, it's going to be more difficult to determine that that's a robot behind there. Also, you're going to have the ability to have those conversations simultaneously. And so with AI, you're having these conversations that are real with multiple people at the same time, making the opportunity for the scammers to have a bigger footprint and get more money. Another one that we're seeing is image and video generation. And so this is the ability for them to, what we're kind of seeing is create an image on a profile, again, with maybe a dating website or a social media profile, that before we would have the tip and say, well, do a reverse search. And if all of a sudden Michael's profile pic shows up on the cover of Motor Trend Magazine and Bass Fishing Weekly, and you're like, well, wait a second, that doesn't seem right. We never talked about any of these things. With AI, you create a one of one. So when you do that reverse search, it's not going to show up anywhere else. So it's going to add legitimacy to that being real. Also, the video generation, you know, if you were talking about, hey, I can quickly, you know, maybe we're doing a rental property and you say, I want to, can you do a walkthrough of that rental property? Well, all of a sudden you do a video generation of what you think it looks like, and it looks like a real tour. So it's making it more difficult to kind of filter that out. Another one we're going to see, and this is one that has been kind of becoming more efficient, is voice cloning.
What?
And so with voice cloning, what that is taking a sample of her voice, which we're going to put a lot out there today.
Yeah.
And using that voice sampling to put it into a program. And so when you're having that conversation on the phone with someone, it sounds like Michelle or Michael or Lee talking to that particular person. And we've watched the time and the amount of sampling that it takes get smaller and smaller as technology evolves. And so you need a smaller sample to make it more convincing. And we see that being used in, say, the family scam, traditionally known as the grandparent scam. We were having a family member call, and you know they would have some type of excuse with they were in an injury, so they sound nasally, and they can kind of get through all of those red flags now because it sounds just like that family member. And it just, again, makes it more convincing. So, you know, the expert you're talking about, it is a challenge because all of these scams are going to be harder to determine as technology gets better.
It becomes more human, sounds more like us, looks more like us, can imitate us better.
Well, to that point, exactly. You know, the last one is deepfake. Sounds like us, looks like us. It's called deepfake videos and technology.
Yeah.
And it's gotten even to the point where we're seeing that you can have live video calls with someone, and in reality, the person's not there at all. However, it looks just like them. It sounds just like them. They're going to have the information that maybe they know about you. That's why they've built about that little repository of, I know what Lee's interests are. I know what he might ask me about, so I'm ready to go. But then also with that chatbot dialogue where I can be responsive to what you're saying. So you could have a call with someone that really isn't even there.
The boss gets on and says, go buy the gift cards.
And exactly. I say, okay, boss, because it sounds just like the boss.
Looks just like him. And
So when the central theme here from the last month of complaints is know who you're talking to, and then you throw artificial intelligence into the mix, it seems to make it exponentially more challenging to figure out who you're talking to when they're so good at being us.
It is making it exponentially harder. And it's the things that we used to look at. Let's take something simple like the phishing scams we would talk about.
Yep.
And you used to get those text messages or letters. And, you know, you could kind of pick out that maybe there's some grammatical errors, some spelling issues. Things don't line up with what you know to be real. Well, with this artificial intelligence, it has the ability to clean all of those up, but then also make sure that if there's any follow-on communication, they know exactly what they should be talking about. And so it's all the different areas and elements, whether it be from inception point of the scam, the middle of the scam, bringing it to the end, it's going to have that opportunity to just make them harder to figure out if you are in fact talking to someone, which is why we emphasize so much is to stop, pause, take a step back. Don't interact right away because you're going to get caught up in finding out. It's very difficult to see what's real, but if you stop and don't no longer kind of interact with that particular person or whoever you think it may be, reach out by yourself, there's a far higher likelihood that you're going to be talking to a real person.
I'm processing.
Yeah, it will be even more important to pay attention to the red flags we can identify. Forms of payment. You know, if they're asking for non-traditional forms of payment.
As soon as gift cards come up, my red flags go off.
That's right. Or peer-to-peer payment apps for paying your utility bill.
Why don't you just send it straight to me?
Yeah. Or going ahead with wiring money, cryptocurrency. That's all going to be really important to identify. If you don't have a moment to think, that urgency, that emotional appeal that they're going to use on you, those will also be the things that we need to be sure we take that breath and don't let those scare tactics intimidate us to take action right away. Let your gut tell you it's too good to be true. That's not that's not the procedure. That's not normal. Nope. I need to go see what the policy or procedures are with my employer in doing this. Let me walk down the hall. Let me make that phone call. Anything that's creating that scare tactic. I mean, think about the toll text scams that came through, the traffic violations. You want to keep your license. You don't want that to be in jeopardy if you have to get to work every day. I want to clear that record and get those things off of there. Wait a minute. How did they get my phone number to pay a toll bill? I never handed out my cell phone number. That's not the procedure in how we pay for and get notified of a toll. It didn't just radio. It just didn't read my cell phone as I drove underneath the antenna type situation. It was a license plate reader. That's not tied to my cell phone. I mean, we just need to take that minute to think and talk through it with a friend, a trusted someone, an authority, a consumer protection, so they can help us identify what's legitimate and what's a red flag.
So beyond complaints, then, you'd field any questions that people might have about legitimacy and whether an organization contacting you is for real.
Oh, yeah. This is where Michael's going to speak so highly of our consumer protection hotline because they deserve every ounce of that.
1-800-422-7128, Michael.
That's the one, and I appreciate the opportunity to brag about them because they do deserve it. So calling our hotline first is you're going to get a real live person real quick. By and large, we're going to answer that phone within less than 30 seconds, and you're going to get us, and you're going to be able to ask that question. So you're not going to sit and wait and say, okay, well, and then have time to kind of process the emotional aspect of what's happening. Once you get one of our experts, they're going to go, they've heard this. They know what's going on, right? So they're going to be that independent source that's going to be able to point out some of those red flags for you. And that's why it's so important to take that pause and talk to someone. But then we're also going to be able to provide you with resources to say, here's some other things that you might want to look out for, because maybe you did engage, maybe you did respond with some information. We'll go ahead and make sure that we safeguard you and say, here's some other things that, don't worry, no big deal. You know, this is what happened, but now we can fix it. And now we can make sure that doesn't happen again, or maybe it happened to a family member. And then after that, the big part is we also have this incredible resource that's on our website called our Ready Reference Guide, which we promote and say, you know what, if there's also somebody else in addition to us who can help out, we'll share that information and refer you over to them. So that one phone call can really provide you with a lot of information and resources. It's easy and it's free.
It's easy and it's free at 1-800-422-7128. Questions or to file a complaint, you can get started right there or at the DATCAP website, datcp.wi.gov. Let's get to some emails here. Daryl emailed. He says, every time it rains, his neighborhood's crawling with roofing contractors looking to do a damage estimate on their roof. How do you know who's legit? And should he just let anyone crawl around on the roof?
Oh, well, this is a fun question because we're certainly coming into that season of not just roofers, but maybe blacktoppers and others that will crawl in. The first thing is, do they have the permission to be there? Did they go register with your municipal government to sell door to door? Many require that. And if you ask that and they can't provide that information, then they're not following the regulations of your community. Is that someone you'd even want to do business with? Second, where are they from? There are some local contractors that will go door to door after a storm just as part of their marketing campaign. And that's someone who's going to be there to follow up with if you choose to engage in business with them, if there's a warranty or a workmanship issue, versus someone who's come in from not just a neighboring community, you know, if you live on the border, but from out of state, many states away. They may take your money and never perform any work, or the work would be questionable.
And you won't be able to find them, right? I mean, they'll be tough to find.
They'll be very difficult to find. And even if you can find them, do you have the legal authority to reach out to them and interact because of jurisdictional issues if they've left the area? So that could all be, I mean, that's down the road, legal troubles type situation. But then you also have to think, do they know the regulations of our state? If they're not from here? Are they going to follow the contract regulations, provide you your consumer rights, that you have a right to a lien waiver? Do they know our insurance laws, if this is an insurance claim,
sure,
and how to communicate and deal with that insurance company? That's all saying that the company you're dealing with from out of state would be legit, let alone the one who's going to swoop in, take the money, disappear, and just be a storm chaser, as they've been nicknamed, where you're never going to see him again, take the money and run. So there's a lot of questions before I let someone just go up on my roof. And, and you know, if you're concerned that you have roof damage from a hailstorm, you talk to your insurance company, you make the calls, you initiate that. You can let that doorbell ring serve as a reminder of, I should get on that.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you have to address it with that person who's at the door.
And in addition to that, if you find yourself in this scenario at the end, Michelle was talking about where you do need repairs,
yeah,
you know, you can provide yourself a little bit of peace of mind by doing some quick research, which is very easy. You can call us at DECAP, and we'll let you know if we have some complaints against that particular business. You can also visit our partners at the Better Business Bureau, see if there's been some complaints. And that does gives you a little bit of peace of mind of saying, hey, you know what? If I had to choose between two contractors and one of them has 100 complaints and one doesn't have any, that might be one of those factors in helping you decide who to go with. You can also ask that contractor for references. You know, they may show up and say, okay, can you give me a couple names of people you've done work for? Yeah. And then you can give them a call and say, hey, were there any issues? So if it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, put up that big blockade and you can't talk to anyone and shouldn't do anything, but you're going to want to make sure you do due diligence before anyone who shows up is going to either get on your roof or start doing that work.
I knew about going to the Better Business Bureau, but I didn't think about reaching out to you guys to see if there's any complaints.
We're the ones responsible for enforcing those laws, so
okay,
we would certainly have those complaints on file if they've been filed. You know, one last thing, don't let them in the house. I mean, that's the basic, but people forget that because you engage in that conversation,
right,
or, you know, the dog is barking and you don't want to, and so why on the doorstep? It's been so hot. Are you going to hold the door open? The mosquitoes are so bad. Do you really want to stand on the front porch talking to them when you're trying to listen and pay attention? Don't relax that you didn't invite them to your door, so you don't want to invite them to your doorstep and into your home.
That's a good rule of thumb, and it goes back to the general rules of pausing and not reacting immediately, taking your own action and agency, and making sure that you verify. All good steps to take from our guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection in the state of Wisconsin. And it's Consumer Protection Day without the phones. So we're taking your emails at talk@WPR.org. Sorry about that. It's just talk@WPR.org to get in on our conversation and your stories and questions about consumer protection. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Good morning. And coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show, Liz Freemuth is back. She'll explain how to add color to your garden this fall. And after that, we'll talk about which plants just do not work well together. Coming up on Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show tomorrow from 11 to 1 on WPR News. Right now, it's Consumer Protection Day, and our guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, are here to help keep you safe. And while our phones may be down, you can still join the conversation by emailing us, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Michelle, you'd mentioned earlier about a pig butchering scam, which sounds very messy. Can you explain this to me?
Well, I can tell you a little story about how this happened, because this is one of our imposters, and there's different ways that this scam has been taking place, and a lot of it deals with an investment scheme. So we heard from a consumer who reported to our agency that they'd been tricked into investing almost $40,000 in fraudulent cryptocurrency by a scammer. The scammer was impersonating a course instructor from this online class this individual had taken. And at the end of the day, when this was all done, it was almost $140,000 lost by this consumer. So this more specifics is that again, this consumer had taken this legitimate online class about how to effectively sell products online through a particular platform, and they were satisfied with the course, pleased when the instructor contacted them later via social media to check on their progress. Mm-hmm. You know, isn't that great?
Yeah.
What the consumer didn't know is that this wasn't really their course instructor.
It was an imposter.
It was a scammer pretending to be that course instructor. So this scammer offered to help this individual invest in cryptocurrency, and after investing through a platform secretly controlled, again, by the scammer, so it was all just part of this setup, the consumer couldn't withdraw any of their investment, and they were faced with these constant obstacles as to trying to do withdrawing, like needing to pay to unlock their account. And after every problem was resolved, another problem occurred that required more money to be put into the resolution by the consumer. So the consumer quit trying to get their money out. That was great. They stopped investing. Some time passed. They happened to check and saw that their investment account had increased to over $1 million.
Ooh.
Right. Attention. So you want to see what you can do here.
I'd like my $1 million, please.
Yeah. Now, it's highly likely this was just a fraudulent amount posted to the account by the scammer to gain this extra attention. So the consumer reached out to this instructor again.
I'd like my $1 million, please.
Yeah. It was still the fake instructor, the scammer. And they wanted to try and retrieve some of the money from their account, and they told it could be shipped to them in the form of physical bills. That's good news. But after another elaborate runaround involving a variety of fake people and businesses, the consumer had paid numerous fake shipping and customs fees, fuel costs, taxes, and all sorts of other miscellaneous costs to have this $1 million delivered to their home. And of course, they never saw any of the money. It never arrived. And they finally, realized this and reported the scam to DadCap. So this is the basics of the beginning of a pig butchering scam, in that they're contacted out of the blue. How you're contacted varies. It could be a random text message that you receive that, you know, hey, Frank, and then you're, this isn't Frank, sorry. Oh, sorry, wrong number. How's the weather there today? And they just strike up this chatty conversation, mm-hmm. and you form this friendship, and you sound pretty nice. Hey, I have this investment opportunity. It could be an entrepreneurial opportunity that we've seen. It could be a romance scam, mm-hmm. that they, let's invest together in this cryptocurrency to, you know, we're falling in love. Let's build our bond by investing together and, and solidify our relationship. Or this now out of the blue imposter with someone that they trust. Yeah. So you get into this investment scheme into cryptocurrency and your account starts to grow. And so you think, hey, I'm going to start to withdraw a little bit of this. Sure, you can do that. You need to pay this. You need to pay that. You need to pay this. All right. So you finally pause because you're never getting anything. You see this huge number and you try again. And sure, we can give you a little. Every once in a while, the scammer will give you just a little nibble, give you a little
just
bit.
A taste.
But here, let's reinvest because look at how this is growing. And you just keep paying. And that's the pig butchering. Then you just give up and you go away. I mean, it's fattening up the pig. You're just building your account.
Yeah.
You're getting you to pay more and more. I mean, it's terrible verbiage, but it's the visual that goes with it. It's this too good to be true opportunity.
In this one case, was the victim able to get any of their money back?
No, unfortunately.
Lost.
At this point, no.
Wow.
You know, these are items that we definitely work with law enforcement on. If they're able, we say cryptocurrency is not traceable. There are rare times when law enforcement, with the right case, it's difficult to do. It's a lot of manpower to do. They have made a few successes out of being able to track and do some recovery, but it's very rare.
Would I treat cryptocurrency like gift cards, or does that make me old-fashioned? Cryptocurrency, maybe you should send up some red flags the way asking for gift cards would?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Cryptocurrency's on our traditional list of if you're asked to pay by gift cards. Before gift cards, it's wiring money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always said don't wire money to someone you don't know and trust. Cryptocurrency's in that because it's like cash. Once it's paid, it's gone. You won't see it again.
There's an email here from Jan who asks if she should simply delete obviously fraudulent texts or should she report them to someone? Michael?
I would say the answer to that is both. It really depends on what the context is of the message, but it doesn't hurt certainly to delete them. But before doing so, letting us know what's going on in that text message is very helpful. There may be some laws under our authority that we could follow up on, but at a minimum, it helps share the messaging of what's going on out there. So then we have opportunities just like this, that if she has this text message and it's something new, it's a variation we haven't heard about, we can make sure that we're spreading that message out there so others know that that's a scam and what's going on.
You guys really want us to reach out to you, don't you?
We really do.
Well, you're the boots on the ground. I mean, the consumers,
first responders.
Consumers are seeing what's happening. They can let us know, let us into it for the investigation. Not only that, programs like this, so we can share and get the word out, so no one is caught off guard about the latest twist or turn that's out there.
You guys do any Instagram shopping?
Instagram shopping?
Yeah.
I do not.
Facebook Marketplace?
No.
Wow, no. You are some consumer protection experts have we got some stories for you?
Michael and I do practice a lot of what we preach.
Yes. That,
or some could say we're Luddites, but yes, that's not true either. Because, we lean over the shoulders of others and see how it's done. But neither one of us is on Facebook.
It's an interesting point to make from the consumer protection experts. Tony here emailed and wants to know if there's any recourse to something purchased online through Craigslist that, shockingly, was not as advertised. It turns out that a friendly phone call to the seller has gone, at least to date, unanswered.
So I don't know what particular recourse Craigslist themselves offers, but depending on who the seller was and how it was promoted, there may be an opportunity for us at DatGap to assist with that. Without knowing more of the details, I can't guarantee that, but it never hurts to reach out and let us know and file a complaint and say this is what was alleged. If it's just a private transaction between two people and they're just, it went sideways, that might be more of a law enforcement issue or it might just be an outright scam. But certainly if it's a scam and we want to hear about it and how it happened and maybe that particular incident or ruse is being commonplace both on Craigslist and Facebook and gives us an opportunity. But I'm not personally aware of what Craigslist might offer and how to rebut that or file some kind of dispute.
I didn't even think that the actual website might have some capacity to involve themselves.
Yeah, most of those larger online platforms do.
Okay.
Your Amazons, your eBays, things like that. They have a very robust opportunity to dispute something that happened and went wrong, and then they have those policies in place to follow up on that, both with the seller and then to address the transaction itself.
Michael in Middleton emailed to ask how you can tell the honest and fair solar panel installers from the scammers. I always thought word of mouth and referral was an important aspect of home improvement.
Right. Well, so as Michael had mentioned earlier when we were talking door-to-door contractors is, first you can contact Consumer Protection to see if there's any complaints. You can check the Better Business Bureau. Yeah. A company might be new, so how are they getting their information? Who are they associated with? Do they belong to any associations or affiliated? Are they working with any other entities in that way? But then also, what representations are they making and how are they validating those representations about the amount of energy savings or energy generation that will come from those solar panels and what will that equate to? But we have a fact sheet actually on solar contractors that it helps ask some of these questions and thinking through that decision. We worked on that with the industry as well as the Public Service Commission and our agency and how solar contracting is a form of home improvement contract. So you're going to want that brochure as well, because they will need to be following the home improvement regulations as it relates to providing a written contract, if any down payments are provided, giving a consumer their rights to receiving a lien waiver and things. And if all of that gives you a blank look, well, that would be a start too in making a decision, I would imagine.
Verify. Make sure you verify. I appreciate that very much. It's Consumer Protection Day on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And it looks like our phones are back, so you can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. We have 30 minutes left with our consumer protection experts, so join us at 1-800-642-1234. Michael Domke and Michelle Reinen are here to share the latest frauds and scams they've seen or attempted attempted across Wisconsin, and to help answer your questions. So you can join our conversation, email anytime, talk@WPR.org, and we will continue after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. It's Consumer Protection Day on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And with us for the next 30 minutes, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the state's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Michelle's the administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michael is the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And our phones are now live, so we will be taking your calls and emails at 800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. And let's start with Pat in Middleton. Pat, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about a call I received just recently within the last 3 or 4 days. And it was from a company called Timeshare Freedom Connect. And they somehow got information that I have a timeshare and wondered if I wanted to get out of it. And so I'm sure there's a cost to it, but I didn't know if that was a legitimate thing that people do or business that, they do.
You do have a timeshare, though, Pat?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So Pat has a timeshare and is getting solicited to get rid of her timeshare through a company called Timeshare Freedom Connect. Michael?
Well, to Pat's point, there are legitimate timeshare resellers and timeshare exit companies. Unfortunately, there are also some more nefarious companies that are offering the same thing and sometimes don't offer any services. So I really would just encourage Pat to be careful. If you aren't looking to get rid of your timeshare at all, then don't engage and just let that go. If you are thinking maybe you want to get into it, certainly do your research ahead of time. We offer a fact sheet on our website on things that you can look out for, certainly in those, whether you're buying or reselling. But then also really making sure that whatever they're promising and what they're going to have to jump offering or what you might have to pay up front is going to fit with what you're actually looking for. Certainly, if you have a company that wants you to pay those fees up front before offering any services, that's someplace you're going to want to pause. Mm-hmm. Looking into the company, as we talked earlier, by calling us or researching online of what those reviews are, having good experiences or poor experiences. And then also, lastly, if you do have those conversations or you have an engagement with them and something isn't quite represented or doesn't follow through as they were supposed to, definitely reach out to us, file that complaint, give us an opportunity to try and make it right. We have familiarity with both the buying and selling and all those different areas, so we can be a great resource to help make sure that you get what you pay for.
I want to make sure we give out that contact information for DATCAP once again. You can call the hotline at 1-800-422-7128. And during business hours, there will be a human being there to answer your questions. That's 1-800-422-7128. The website is datcp.wi.gov. That's datcp.wi.gov. And Barbara emailed us. She says, the DATCAP's website is vast. So how does one search for complaints against a certain business? Would those even be found online, or should you make the call?
Yeah, those you need to make the call for. Okay. If you are searching for the businesses, it's not something we have as part of our website where there's any kind of search box for that. You'll want to be sure to call us during those business hours of 7:45 to 4:30. If you call after hours, you can leave a voicemail message, and we can return that call to you live where you want, or again, just leave you a message back with that information.
And that number again, Pat, for you is 1-800-422-7128, 800-422-7128. Let's go to Jim in Ashland next. Jim, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you. I'm just angry even thinking about this, but I think I better remind or tell some of your listeners. I got a biopsy done for cancer recently, and the medical authority said, well, we'll let you know by letter and such and such a time, before such and such a time. Well, I don't know. By randomly, the next week later, I get a call early in the morning, and it says, sir, this is the cancer testing center. I told him I never heard of it, you know, and I showed some resistance. And then the voice says, it was a woman, she says, sir, you're a sick man, implying, you know, that she has some information that,
yeah,
that I don't know. Well, when you're frightened, you're gullible, and luckily I just hung up on them. But anyway, it's out there apparently.
So you went to get a biopsy and you were waiting for your results, and you think a scammer actually contacted you after that, somehow knowing that you'd had some tests done?
It's a scammer. It was, I mean, it was obvious it wasn't legitimate.
Well, now, Jim, I'm mad. I understand your anger. I'm kind of outraged at taking advantage of something like this. Michelle, is this common?
Well, we certainly have seen more and more scams and complaints and reports of scams that are more targeted, spear phishing, if you will, where there's some form of the scammer being able to compile data about an individual and specifically point a scam or a threat towards an individual that would be unique to their circumstances. I can't think for Jim's circumstance what exactly that would be, you know, what monitoring's done, what connection, what affiliation that they got this data. But I'm so happy he recognized it was a scam.
Yes.
and disconnected. That information would come from your doctor and only communicate. And I think that's the message for everyone else. You know, when you have to go in for any medical test or any kind of interaction with an entity and you're going to get follow-up information, how are you going to deliver that to me? Who will that come from, so you can be confident that who you're talking to is who you should be talking to? And what information are you going to need from me to confirm? Because with medical, they want you to, okay, validate your date of birth,
right,
before I tell you anything. And I almost got hung up on that. And I think it's the last time we talked,
yes,
where I had just gotten that call to move that appointment and almost gave it to him and like, no, I got to go
call
them. How
do I know you're you?
Right. So when you have those situations, try and confirm. I think that's what we can take from Jim's in that learning piece of it. And Jim, if you want to file that complaint with us, we certainly share our information with the Federal Trade Commission. Again, that might be something that needs a global look.
Phone number is 800-422-7128 to do that, Jim. And Jim, did you get your actual biopsy results? Are you okay?
I'm okay. It came from a letter from, actually, it's the VA, the Veterans Administration. So thank you for letting me vent.
No, I thank you, and I'm glad to hear you're okay, and thank you for sharing your story in hopes that it might help others. I very much appreciate your call. We'll go to Richard and Melrose next. Richard, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Got a little problem. Had a Ford pickup, got about 80,000 miles on it, and had a warranty till 80,000, extended warranty. And I was thinking about trading it off, but I got a thing from Ford, I got my warranty through Ford, and it said, well, if you want to extend your warranty for a while, you can do it monthly or whatever. And I thought, well, maybe for 6-8 months until I get rid of it, maybe I'll do that. So I line it up with them, and they charge me monthly. I went to get a small thing fixed on it at a Ford dealer, and I told them I had this endurance service contract. They called them, and they said, no, we don't cover that. And, well, they called my Ford coverage first, and they said, well, you don't have that anymore. Huh. And then I said, well, I got this endurance I thought that was the same company because they had my exact Ford logo, my mileage, my VIN number, exact mileage on my truck, like within 2 weeks. And I thought, well, it must be the same company. Well, anyway, this company doesn't cover hardly anything yep. that would interest me. So I called them and I said, okay, this is a monthly deal. I'm going to get rid of the truck, so just quit taking it out of my automatic withdrawal. And they just hang. They said, yeah, sure, we will. And they just hang up. And I called three different phone numbers. And they said, oh, sure, we'll help you. We'll get you a customer service. Mm. And they never answer.
Sure. Have you reported this to anybody yet, Richard?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you're going to want to let some people know, but let's ask Michael Domke what Richard can do now that that extended car warranty turns out to be a scam.
Yeah, Richard, I would really encourage you to file a complaint with our agency, with the Bureau of Consumer Protection, and give us an opportunity to look at what documentation was provided to you, what terms and conditions, what they said it would cover, what it did or didn't. And if there's any misrepresentations in there, we would have an opportunity to try and rectify that and make it right. Also, with your attempt to cancel and them not, you know, canceling that or continuing to make those payments, all those things are something that we can help out with. I would just encourage you to file that complaint, make sure you include all the documentation you have, and then we'll look into it.
So these, we've had a common theme so far with just the callers alone. Jim had somebody who had some medical information that they were trying to use to scam him. Richard here had some car information that scammers found and were trying to use to actually get money from him. Let's go to Carol in DePere next. Carol, good afternoon.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have an adult son who lives in a different state. And he recently bought property in a third state, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I get an info, and I don't recall if it was text or email, saying my name, hello, Carol, and naming my son's first name, and that he, this person, whoever, has property adjacent to what was purchased, and perhaps my son would be interested in acquiring this extra land. And I just, I mean, I couldn't get a hold of my own son. I just never answered it.
Yeah.
And when I finally discussed it with family, we just deleted it.
And yet,
he thinks they got a hold of, you know, just records.
Yeah, so through public records, they were able to identify your son who recently bought some property and were able to pose as a neighboring property owner with a offer to sell land that they most likely did not even have. Is that about it, Carol?
Well, that's what I'm assuming, but how'd they get me?
Yeah, and it's a third call in a row now where they found some personal information and tried to use it against, in this case, Carol.
I agree. And I think what's happening here is we're starting to see again that theme of not both spear phishing that we talked about earlier about aggregating some data, but then also exploiting some public information that's out there and using those, whether it be the deed that's out there or sales information other than that municipal website.
Is there a discrepancy between what we feel our information is out there and how much actual information about us is out there? Are we just missing how much data is being collected about us and is available? Is that part of the rub here?
Yeah, it'd be really interesting for individuals to go out and Google their name and look at what their data footprint is. It may be much larger than they realize between what you share
it
and
sounds
post,
scary.
What's publicly available,
yeah.
and what others share about you and how you may get tagged, you know, being connected in that way and just affiliated. And then there's the fourth area where people are just compiling data about you that may or may not be accurate as well.
Right. And, you know, if you just do some of those free website searches out there for a person, you know, oftentimes they'll show you who they think associates are, who might be a relative. And so if her, you know, Carol's son, they found out about a property, do a quick personal search, find out that Carol's potentially a mother or a relative, and they reach out, you know, you can see how this starts getting put together pretty easily.
Carol, it sounds like she made all the right moves in this case, though, by not engaging, by stopping and trying to verify. And
she talked with the rest of the family about it. That was wonderful. She just didn't keep it to herself and jump on something for her son. You know, all here's a gift, more property.
All the right things, Carol. And thank you for sharing. And I very much appreciate the call at 1-800-642-1234. We'll go to Carrie in Balsam Lake next. Carrie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I am traveling to London, my husband and I, and they require a visa. They call it an ETA if someone is coming from the U.S. Well, I applied, and it looked official, the site, and they had me enter my passport number, you know, when it was issued, when it expires, and then a credit card number because it costs about $10 or something. And they said, this credit card doesn't work. Well, I entered it twice, and I know it's the correct, you know, number. And so my husband texted me because we're, you know, in different areas right now. And he said, did you just get charged or use the Barclay card for $299?
Whoa.
I was like, what? So now they have my passport number and his, and we declined the money, you know.
Sure, the charge.
Now I'm really worried.
Okay, but you're not alone, Carrie. You're not alone. I have heard stories like these before, and I'm sure Michelle and Michael have as well.
Yeah, you're going to want to contact the federal government to let them know that your passport number has been compromised and
shared. Who in the federal government?
I'm trying to remember who issues them. The Department of State.
Okay.
Thanks, Michael. Go to the Department of State website. You can then there search passports. They'll probably have a phone number that you can call to report that the number's been compromised. So that's on file. They'll be able to guide you with what needs to happen in relations to that, if a replacement will be issued. And given your trip is upcoming, how that impacts your travel in that way. But with the credit card company, you may have declined the charges, but also report it to the credit card company so they are either actively monitoring or can decide if they want to replace the card.
Yes, because they've got the number now, and
they do.
They did a fraudulent charge. It was $10, according to Carrie, and then it turned into $299.
Right.
So that's fraud on its own.
It is. And so the credit card companies decide how they want to do that. Often it's to issue you a new card, a new number, and redirect things. But sometimes they'll just continue to monitor the situation if they've been able to shut it down and block things. So just be sure that that happens as well as part of it. And if you didn't give any other information, okay, great. If you've given anything else, now we need to start breaking down how else you need to monitor. And that's the important thing for everyone, is regardless of interactions, monitoring your credit report. You can do that weekly, for free if you're checking online. You need to put a security freeze on your credit report, lock that down. That protects your Social Security number as it relates to extensions of credit, because it's associated with Social Security number. But you should be monitoring your bank statements, monitoring your credit card statements, monitoring your work, and monitoring your driver's license record. I mean, it can seem like a chore, but if you kind of put it in there to do regular monitoring, put fraud alerts on things where they are available to you, you will get notifications, and then you just can't ignore them. You need to act and respond to them when you get notified of activity that is not yours.
Well, the investment of monitoring seems to be much less than the investment of cleaning up after an identity theft or fraud.
Certainly can be, yeah.
It absolutely is. And there's a lot of preventative things you can do that are easy and free and helps you stay informed. And then at that point, too, as you mentioned, that little bit of front-end effort can save you years of cleanup effort on the back end.
Years.
Years.
Margin River Falls emailed us. She was in line at the post office yesterday, and there were two people in front of her who were paying for counterfeit postage on packages that were sent to them. They were encouraged to get a hold of the sender with their postal receipt to see if they could recover their money. Could people just plop a package on your front door and then say you owe?
Well, the silence right there speaks
volumes. Yeah.
I mean, I guess
stumped
if you
them.
Wanted the package, I guess it's maybe on you to go in and pay for it. If you weren't expecting it and a package just showed up and you had to pay postage, I would just take it in and return it.
I don't want the package.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to pay for the package if you don't want the package.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, unsolicited mail, there's no requirement that you pay for unsolicited goods and packages in our state either. I thought where you were going to go was the fake postage that's sold online at discounts. We certainly talk about that, and callers inform us
fake postage?
That there is counterfeit postage available for reduced prices that's not U.S. postage that looks like. So,
well, how the heck do you verify U.S. postage?
You go get it from the post office. You know, I mean, but there are other sites trying to sell reduced postage.
Let me ask the silly questions here so you can give the obvious answers. You go to the post office. That's what you do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's easy enough.
It's go to that legitimate source that you verified, which is the post office.
There's your central theme for our story today. Let's go to Ryan and Thorpe quickly. Ryan, good afternoon.
Hey, hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great, thanks. What do you have for us?
Well, I got a good one for you. I'll try to make it quick, but I get like 20 to 30 phone calls a day, so I got my phone set up where it just everything goes to voicemail. But anyway, there was this one number that kept calling, so I answered it, and here, it was foreign, but they were asking me, they said there was some fraud on my debit credit card, and they needed to verify the last the expiration date and the last three and the code on the back,
the three-digit code that's on the back of the credit card. Gotcha.
Yes. So I refused, and you know, it's almost a scam and this and that, whatever, and hung up. Well, they called back the next day, and I did the same thing. And then the next day, a guy called, and I flat out asked him, "What do you guys get out of scamming people?" he denied it and denied it and denied it and all that. No, this is real, you know. And I says, I know it's not real. I says, you're not even in the United States. And I know there's a lot of people with accent and this and that. And so my wife is always telling me I can make friends with anybody. So I finally got him to admit it was a scam. And I says, you know, and then I repeated myself, what do you guys get out of scamming people out of their money? And he goes, well, we're not stealing from you. And I'm like, well, you most certainly are. And he goes, no, because we'll get the money from your bank account, and then you're going to file a claim, and your government will put that money back in there under FDIC or whatever, and your government is rich.
So they don't see it as stealing from you. I appreciate that perspective, Ryan, and thanks for getting it for us, because we have it. They'll take it? Because it's insured in some way, or maybe to some degree, that it's not theft?
I think there's a wide variety of psychologies as to why scammers are doing it and maybe how they justify what they're doing. But what was happening there is also not true. You know, a financial institution doesn't inherit the responsibility to return funds if somebody unfortunately falls victim to a scam. So that's the important thing we want to remember. Make sure the listeners don't think that, hey, this bank's going to automatically return the money, because that's not the case.
Not the case. Ryan, I appreciate you following up and doing the investigation, but next time you may just want to let that call go unanswered. Michelle and Michael, I want to thank you for keeping us up to date here, keeping us safe, and letting us know what we can do. And I think the two contact points of contact for DATCAP are worth giving out once again. The website, datcp.wi.gov. That's datcp.wi.gov. The hotline with humans during business hours waiting for you, 1-800-422-7128. That's 800-422-7128. Michelle, Michael, I'm sure we'll do this again. Thank you for doing it with me today. Very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Lee.
Michael Domke and Michelle Ryan from our Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. When we continue, what's the course like for somebody who wants to become a U.S. citizen today? What does that path look like? What are the impediments? And who are the next U.S. citizens? An immigration attorney from Wisconsin joins us next to answer those questions. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. What would it take to become a U.S. citizen today, right now? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show, and our next guest leads Immigration Legal Services for the Catholic Multicultural Center based in Madison. Carmel Carpati is here to answer questions about the immigration process, how it has changed, and the path to U.S. citizenship. So we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Carmel, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, and for starters here, what's the Catholic Multicultural Center? Why is it involved in immigration services in Wisconsin? What's the connection there?
So our agency, while we have a number of services that we provide, we have an immigration legal services program that's been in existence for, I think since 2012. So our sort of agency's goal is for our immigration program is to help newcomers or help those not from the United States become integrated and become more like neighbors.
So what kind of services do you provide, Carmel?
So for our immigration legal services, so for Catholic Multicultural Center in general, we have basic services such as a food pantry, free meal program, ESL classes and job training, and then for our immigration, to name a few. And for our immigration program, we provide services to individuals who are seeking mostly affirmative immigration benefits, which really mostly encompasses family-based petitions and humanitarian-based petitions. We don't do employment-based applications, which would be when a company or business would be trying to petition to get more workers to their company. Mm-hmm. And we don't do too much removal defense. We do a little bit of that, but mostly it's what we consider in the affirmative realm.
And Carmel, what's your role in helping people through this immigration process?
So I am the managing attorney with our immigration program, and we have a staff of myself, another immigration attorney, a DOJ accredited rep, a legal assistant, some volunteer attorneys, and then two more staff, which will be hopefully joining us in the next few weeks.
Oh,
so we're growing, actually.
So who are the people that you work for? Who are some of the immigrants that you come across? How would you describe them?
So for our services and who we are providing services to, last year we served people from 85 different countries. So it's a quite a big range of people whom we serve. And I think our numbers of just for last year alone, we provided services or consultations to close to 1,000 people last year. But in terms of who we serve, those would be refugees, refugees who are here seeking to apply for legal permanent residence, DACA recipients who want to renew, people want to apply for citizenship, a huge spectrum of different kinds of cases come across our paths. And for a person to actually qualify for our services, it's based upon geography and also financial. So if a family is at 300% or below the federal poverty guidelines for that household size, we can serve them. And also if they live within our geographic area of basically it's 11 counties.
11 counties in the South Central Wisconsin area?
That is correct.
What have you seen changed in the past year, Carmel? And what are you experiencing in your line of work with changes to immigration, questions about immigration, and deportations underway?
Yes. So as people or your listeners can probably imagine, there have been a lot of changes under this administration, specifically under immigration law, and as a result, very basically saying we are extremely busy. We were pretty busy to start with last year, but in the past 6 months, we have gotten much more busy with a lot of uncertainty, yeah. with our clients or potential clients not really knowing what their options are now, just because of the increase in changes under federal immigration law. So with the, you know, with the constant changes and rapid changes, we have to sort of be up to date on the various laws and be able to counsel people as best as we can, also knowing that those policies might change the next day, or you know, there might be a lawsuit filed to try to stop a particular action from being enforced, and it might be on pause. So a lot of these, I would say the biggest change has been the increase in volume, but also the uncertainty by our clients, but also by practitioners, because we have to, you know, try to keep on top of all the different changes that are going on.
And how do you do that as an immigration attorney right now?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we're constantly having to do legal education, attending webinars, talking with colleagues. Our agency, Catholic Multicultural Center, is an affiliate of a larger organization called Clinic, which has affiliates all across the country. And it's really great being an affiliate of Clinic because they offer sort of nationwide, you know, guidance, but also technical support for maybe kind of thorny, you know, cases that we're not really sure, you know, what we could do or should do. So we have a lot of resources and people who are experts who are also staying on top of these changes nationwide.
Carmel Carpati is our guest, lead immigration legal services for, she leads immigration legal services for the Catholic Multicultural Center based in Madison. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Carmel, you'd mentioned the uncertainty among the immigrants that you serve. Is there fear there as well?
Definitely. There is a lot of fear. Fear of potentially being separated from family members, fear of, you know, they might have had a petition or an application pending to bring a family member to the United States to live permanently, and now maybe that petition has been put on hold, or, you know, has maybe there's a likelihood that it's going to be denied greater than what it was before. Fear that they might get picked up by ICE. It's very clear that the uncertainty has caused a lot of fear among those people who are serving.
Seen some news stories about people who are here in the United States legally who have decided to self-deport. Have you seen any stories of self-deportation in your work, Carmel?
Some.
Okay.
But also I think so for folks who are here legally, possibly, I would say that those who are actually, who might have a legal status here and who might have an ability to apply for something that would allow them to stay here permanently, probably they would not use that option of self-deporting if there is another option available to them. And when I say that, I mean like since we work in the family realm, it might be an application that a family member is able to file for them that would allow them to stay here, or humanitarian options such as asylum or potentially a U visa case, something that, you know, maybe they have a good case that they could wait it out here until that case gets decided.
Has the path to U.S. citizenship been changed in any way with the changes to immigration policy here in the United States?
That's also a good question. So, you know, in our experience as an agency or as a service provider, we do file a lot of citizenship applications. We did, you know, before there was a change in the administration, and we continue to do so. We're still getting those approved. So, we think that's, you know, obviously that's a great thing. And we continue to file those applications. One thing I would note is that the length of time that it takes to decide an application, like for example, for citizenship, I think is slowing down. So while we're still seeing approvals, we're still seeing people get interviewed and get scheduled for oath swearing in ceremonies, it's just taking longer, but they're getting approved.
And when you say taking longer, what's that time frame, generally speaking, look like?
Oh, gosh. I would say perhaps over a year from the time of filing an application.
Okay.
And I think one important thing to remember is that everybody's case is different. And
right.
So everyone, there might be circumstances in one person's case, they might look, you know, on its face to be similar, but there's definitely going to be differences. So, you know, I would say maybe over a year, maybe 15 months.
What's the cost look like?
So that has also been, that's also a really good question, because there was an increase in filing fees for certain applications that didn't, you know, that were not, these filing fees might not have been in existence last month. But for citizenship specifically, it's pretty high. It's $760 to file for citizenship application if you're filing on paper. You can also file online for $710.
Carmel Capati is our guest. She leads immigration legal services for the Madison-based Catholic Multicultural Center. And we're talking about the path to U.S. citizenship, the changes to immigration, the uncertainty, and some of the fear that now exists, and what can be done about it, what the path to citizenship looks like today, and who our new U.S. citizens will be down the road. 800-642-1234 to join our conversation. You can also send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. Join us again tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show. It's Friday, and that means Garden Talk from 11 to 1. Liz Freemuth is back. She'll be explaining how to add color to your garden through the autumn. And then we'll take a look at the plants that just for one reason or another refuse to grow well together. Coming up on Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show, that's tomorrow from 11 to 1. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And our guest is Carmel Capati, who leads immigration legal services for the Catholic Multicultural Center based in Madison. Taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or emailing talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Jonah in Caledonia. Jonah, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
So my grandma came to the U.S. from France when she was in her early to mid-20s. We called her Mammy. Mammy wasn't treated very well, unfortunately, by the people in my hometown. She spoke different. She dressed different. And they kind of turned up their noses at her. And I feel like if they had the kind of push, if the people in my hometown had the kind of push they do now to suspect their neighbor of wrongdoing, I don't know if she would have stayed. But point is, I'm wondering how the prejudice she experienced in, you know, like the 50s in Wisconsin, how it compares to the prejudice that immigrants are experiencing now in the modern day. I'm wondering if the guest has can shed any light on that subject.
I can certainly relate, Jonah. My great-grandma came from Italy, refused to speak English, and also faced some tough times as an immigrant here in this country, and that's not lost on the rest of my family. And Carmel, what do you see about how the landscape of prejudice has changed over the time, or if it's just shifted, or if perhaps it hasn't changed at all?
Well, that's a, again, these are, it's a great question. You know, I also, my own family's experience, we are a family of immigrants. I am from the Philippines, and my we came here as immigrants in the 1960s. And actually, my parents settled in a rural area in Wisconsin. And there at that time, there was certainly challenges, I would say, with, you know, people like us who are brown folks who were in an area that maybe didn't see a lot of people who looked like us. So has it changed? I think what I feel like it's just gotten more verbal, I guess, or more I don't know, maybe that there's more I don't know, willingness to state your issues or prejudices maybe in public or to someone directly that then maybe it wasn't in the past. I'm not really sure. I feel like it's always been an issue though. But you know, maybe it's just sort of manifesting in different ways now. I don't know. It's a good question.
It is. And I appreciate you asking it, Jonah. Let's go to James and Merton next. James, good afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. I just had a question for your guest. Given the fact that a religion is within the title of her company and the services, are there any restrictions on or any faith restrictions for the clients that they represent? And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay, you can take it either way, James, but it's a fair question as our guest leads the Immigration Legal Services for the Catholic Multicultural Center. Are there religious restrictions, Carmel?
No. Not at all. Okay. we our clients are a spectrum of faiths, no faiths, different kinds of faiths. That's not at all a criteria for us.
Michael in Middleton emailed and asked if an ICE raid arrest automatically shifts someone from civil immigration system from the civil immigration system to the criminal system. Does an ICE raid arrest make you a criminal in the eyes of the law?
Not necessarily. I guess one of the issues would be what was the basis for perhaps an ICE arrest in the first place? I think what sort of has been, you know, out in the public is that if someone has a criminal record or something, they're going to be a target for ICE, not necessarily not, there's not necessarily parameters as to what that type of, you know, criminal activity might be, but that has definitely been a message that we're receiving. So I think the question is, you know, you can kind of, there's going to be two different systems. So there's going to be a state criminal potential charge, I guess, along with a potential civil immigration enforcement case going on as well. So there might be two types of cases going on.
Are you seeing ICE raids in Wisconsin, Carmel?
In Madison, we haven't. I don't believe that we've seen ICE raids on particular, you know, employers or, you know, large scale like that, maybe in other states that have larger immigration populations. I haven't. I'm not saying that they don't occur or haven't occurred, but we're not, at least I'm not aware of it.
I think it's worth reiterating here, because sometimes the goldfish doesn't know what the water is in the fishbowl, that if you're in the middle of it, you don't necessarily understand it. And I think perhaps you've got a unique perspective from your personal story and your professional work. Who wants to be a U.S. citizen, and why are they willing to risk deportation to a country they've never been to? Why are they willing to face some prejudice? Who is it that wants to come here and be and stay here? What makes a person want to be a U.S. citizen in your mind, Carmel?
Again, a really great question, which I do ask, but normally, you know, the people who we see as our clients have left pretty dire situations and circumstances in their home country. I think it's fair to say it is not an easy decision that someone has to make to leave their country. It is not an easy decision. And for them to make that decision to risk their lives to actually just get to the United States has to tell you something like, well, it must have been pretty bad from where they came from, right? So why would people want to stay and risk that for opportunity to make a decent living, to be able to support their families, to be able to send their kids to good schools? Sort of the same reasons why Americans want to be in the United States, right? For those very same reasons, for opportunities, and that might not exist in their home countries. And again, people, you know, they wait for years and years and years here in the United States, waiting for a possible application to get adjudicated. And they're willing to do it because they believe that the end result is worth it.
What do you say to people who are not here legally right now, people who may have overstayed their visas or people who entered without permission? What is there legal advice that you provide to them in general?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with our, you know, with our legal services program, we do this all the time. We have sort of general options, consultations for people who might be in that situation, like you're talking about. They might be undocumented. They're not really sure if they have an option. Mm-hmm. They might have an option that they just aren't aware of. So when they have a consultation with us, we go through the various, you know, details of how they entered into the United States, family members who might have legal status, you know, all these sorts of other screening type questions where we could possibly try to find something that they are legally eligible to apply for under immigration law. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, I would say most of the consultations we have, there is an option for them. Not all of them, can say. Because we do consultations with people and we, you know, we scan and screen for every possible item. And at the end of the consultation, we determine that there is no lawful option for them to apply for permanent, you know, permanent status here in the U.S. And we have to tell them that, right?
So even if somebody is here not legally in the United States, they can still reach out to you and contact you?
Absolutely.
What's the best way to do that, Carmel?
The best way to do that is to contact our legal assistant who screens all of our individuals who either email or call and just say, you know, I don't know if I have any option. I would like a consultation. I can give that number.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The number is 608-441-0114. And that's the number of our assistant who will go through our little screening questions and see if it's a type of case also that we would be able to take.
608-441-0114. Is there potential for referral notices or referral support for people who might be outside your service area, Carmel?
For those outside of our service area, they will probably get referred because our service area is under the Diocese of Madison, and that's the 11 counties.
Right.
And so if it's outside of that 11 counties, you know, the person lives outside, then they would have to go to a different agency.
That phone number again, 608-441-0114. Carmel Capati, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You as well. Carmel leads the Immigration Legal Services for the Madison-based Catholic Multicultural Center at 608-441-0114. I want to thank you for being a part of the show today, and always thanks to our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaude, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Join us again tomorrow for Garden Talk from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News.